Spirit, earth and sky and sea, you are inside and all around me. Oh, great Spirit, earth and sky and sea. Oh, great Spirit, earth and sky and sea.
Let me invite you to just allow your eyes to close and to take a few nice, deep breaths. To become aware of the experience of breathing in and breathing out. And in this moment of quiet, to meditate is to come back again to the spirit of the Christ, which is the spirit of love, which is present in everyone and everything. And so as you breathe, maybe thinking as you breathing into your strong back, the strong back that takes its seat and takes its place here and now. And as you breathe out, it's an out-breath of softening and opening and relaxing your heart. So there's this quality of a strong back and a soft front that can open to life, that can open to love, and that can open to God. Just as it is. The good news is that we are already chosen. We are already accepted. God's mind is already made up. So it's just noticing where in our life maybe is there resistance or maybe confusion. Can you just live in the peace of this moment? And then with that strong back and that soft front, coming back to your breath, arriving, being here, taking a couple more breaths, and then as you're ready, gently opening your eyes. Thank you, Julie. This is just magic up here. That last song reminds me of Saint Francis. Saint Francis of Assisi. Saint Francis was one of these rare folks who brought people back to what we talk about here, this thing called Christ consciousness. Christ is not Jesus' last name. Okay, Christ is the spirit that Jesus lived. I won't go down that and preach that message again. Don't worry. But he saw the divine in everything. Brother sun, sister moon, brother fire, sister water. I may not have those exactly right, but trees, mountains, the air. And then in all the beings, you know, just take a moment and just look at the beings who are around you and just take them all in, you know. There's the light and the expression of God that's here. And something that St. Francis said that was so profound, he said, preach this good news every day. Preach this good news every day of your life. If necessary, I like that. And joining me here today is someone who lives that. And I'm so, so excited for you to hear from him and just get to know him a little bit. Mark Bauman is someone that I've known for, at least eight years, maybe nine years. And he has been a personal friend to me, a very special friend with me, who has walked with me through the leaving of my life as an evangelical Christian pastor, through all of the heartache and difficulty of that, through the reemergence of finding, you know, a new church in Seattle, going through a second marriage and divorce. He has been through, you know, a faithful friend. We've laughed together, cried together, work out together. CrossFit has been our thing. That's the, you may notice that on the shirt there. So fitness has been our main point of contact. The guy's an animal. He's in shape, man. He runs circles around you. But I have been impressed by the life that Mark and his wife, Lisa, and his family have in this area of sharing the news of love, particularly with welcoming and loving the stranger, the outsider. You know, this living love thing is easy when we're with people who think like us, look like us, act like us, believe like us, right? You know, but what about those outliers? What about those ones whose, you know, skin might be a different color, whose sexual orientation might be different, whose country might be different, whose state might be different, okay? You know, whatever, you know. How are we at welcoming and receiving those? Mark and his family live it, and they live it in a very compelling way. Many of you here do the same thing. I'm being a little funny here, but many of you here do the same thing. And my hope and prayer is that what you hear today will just deepen and strengthen and help you maybe imagine new ways that you can live this life of love and uplifting lives in creative ways. I think of Mark and Lisa as like edge walkers and pioneers, you know, in doing this work. And so I'm really, really excited for you to hear from him today. So would you please help give a very warm welcome to Mark Bauman.
Thanks. Thank you, James. It's great to be with all of you today. As he was talking about my fitness, all I could think was, I'm going to trip coming up these stairs. So thankfully, that has been averted so far. But yeah, it's been a privilege to know James and just to be part of his journey. As he's gone on a journey, he's helped bring me on a journey as well and has helped grow me in my faith. And it's been great just being part of his life and really, by extension, being part of the life of this church community as well. So thank you. As I was reflecting on today, I realized, oh, it's pretty easy to like make things sound very linear on how my wife and I got to where we're at. It's been anything but linear. And so I'll try my best to make it seem to bring you on the journey. But just know there's so much that happens sort of behind the scenes that we all know that we don't get to where we're at just following a roadmap. There's always starts and stops and like, yay, things are going great. And then what am I doing? And so I'll try to convey some of that as we share and spend time together today. Part of sort of welcoming the outsider or the stranger, as I was preparing for this, I'm like, gosh, I think the seeds of this for my wife and I were planted many, many years ago, actually as a kid. We moved around a bit, moved around 3 times before I was 10. And we moved to the Tri-Cities in Southeast Washington. You may have been through there on your way to somewhere else. not sure who really goes to the Tri-Cities, maybe other than the boat races. but I saw how people received my parents and received our family when we moved to a community. And then I saw how they, in turn, as they moved and established roots in the Tri-Cities, were able to receive and welcome others. My wife and I experienced that after we were married, and we moved to Chicago for about 5 years. And, we hadn't even moved in. We were taking boxes out of the truck, and a local pastor came and helped. I mean, it was just amazing how we've been received, and that's, I think, really helped inform our receiving of others. And so I'll share some about that today. It was great hiking yesterday with James and Sport. Since I do currently live in Seattle, I probably am a little bit responsible for the clouds and the cooler temperatures. So sorry about that. I would have much preferred 85 yesterday because it would have felt like jumping in the lake. but I think part of our journey for my wife and I has really been saying yes to things. And often it's like saying yes to things without us knowing what we're saying yes to. It's just going along. Maybe it's the relationship we have with the person who is saying, hey, why don't you come and try this or come and do this? And like we might like, you know, fight an internal struggle. It's like, do we say yes? It doesn't make sense. Why are we saying yes? And then we just say yes. And it's amazing what God is able to do through one saying yes. So for I'll say this current journey of ours, we said yes to going on a trip from our church to India. And so this picture is taken from the Jama Masjid, like the largest mosque in Delhi, overlooking part of Old Delhi. And I'm just always amazed when I see this photo, just the density of living that takes place in this. It kind of reminds me of stories in the Old Testament where people are on the rooftop looking out. And it's very much like that in this part of Delhi. But we really didn't know. It was like our church had a partnership with a ministry in India that was doing amazing things. Just seeing people come to faith, So we're like, okay, we'll go. We'll see what God's up to. And wow, we were blown away. It was just amazing to be in a country of a billion plus people, where you saw faith expressions of Hinduism, people who were Christian, people who were Muslim. I mean, for those of you who don't know, India is probably the second or third most populous Muslim country in the world, but we only think of it as a Hindu country, really. So we just got exposed to a lot of expressions of faith. And what really impacted us was the vibrancy of the church across North India. There was just the, let's see here. Yeah, I mean, the encounters that people were having with God was amazing. So when I think about part of saying yes is like, who are you going to say yes to? Who are you going to listen to? And who are you going to learn from? And so going to India on this trip, I realized we have so much to learn in our own faith from the faith of others. And this is just one of the gatherings I've been to over the years where just the vibrancy that people have in their expression of reverence to God is just phenomenal. I mean, they can go on praying and worshiping in song and, you know, for hours, I would say, you know, well over an hour. And I just kind of sit in awe and I look at my own faith. And it's like, what have I said yes to in my own faith? Does my faith represent or reflect the same or even a fraction of the reverence that they have and the joy that they have? I mean, so much joy amidst so much hardship in many cases. And it's just the vibrancy that is compelling in my own faith. And so just even my own journey has been impacted by listening and experiencing the faith of the church in India. I think my wife and I, you know, made several trips to India, and we'd come back and we're like, what does that mean to us here? You know, it's easy to experience one thing in another context, in a different state, a different city, a different country. But how do I take what God's speaking to me and what I'm learning from others? How does that impact me here? And so that has been part of our journey, listening to and learning from others. I'll get to this in a second, but I'd like to say this will be available after the service, but it's not. with listening to and learning from others, we spend a lot of time currently with people from other faith backgrounds. And it is amazing what one can just by spending time with others. Even thinking about Family Promise? What's the organization in Post Falls? Just by showing up there, serving, it'll be incredible what you can hear and learn and just experience by being with people maybe in different stages of life. And so that's been a big part of our journey of getting to saying yes to welcoming the stranger or saying yes to others. I'll just go back to this slide. I went with like three or four people, probably 15 years ago. The partner we had in India had a need, and there was someone in our church who knew how to design and build, so our architect, a meeting hall that didn't have beams. It had, I'll draw like trusses, so that the sight line was like this, unimpeded. And so our partner was like, you don't need to bring workers. Like, we have all the labor, but just come and bring this guy who can help us architect and design this. So a few of us went, and every morning started with a time of prayer, with a time of worship, and just reverence before God. And then they'd go work all day. The joy that they had in the midst of what they were doing was incredible. And it taught me a big lesson. One night, they were trying to reach a certain milestone in the project, and they're working by, you know, lights powered by generators, because this is in a rural part of India, and I was just like, oh, are we ever going to finish? I just want to go to bed, so, I mean, in all transparency, and so we finally reached a point where we're done, and have a bite to eat. There's a time at the end of the day where they pray and just meet. And then it was like, okay, time for bed. So those of us who had traveled, we go into where we're sleeping. And then a few minutes later, I hear joyful noise of just prayer and worship. And I probably swore, like, this mixture of, like, I don't want to miss out. I want to be part of what they're experiencing with, I just want to go to sleep. So I dragged myself out of bed and went and enjoyed probably like half an hour of just joy as they were with the Lord. I mean, it was amazing. And, I mean, it was a lesson to me. And so one of the things that I've done in the last few years, off and on and pretty consistently now, to help me just be reminded of that we're created in God's image, like I think you said, like, the sacred is inside of, like, it's because we're created in God's likeness and his image. How do I spend more time with him? So I actually, a friend of mine who's Catholic, talked about prayer beads. And so these aren't like a rosary, but they're similar. And so I work my way through this probably multiple times a day. I can be in my car and it's just, you know, in my right hand, or I've done enough, I just know kind of like what I'm praying along the way. So it's been a great way for me practically to encounter God on a regular basis and to pray for others, pray for those in the community who maybe are sick or have a big test or something coming up. So I've been using prayer beads, and a little bit, they don't use them in this context, but it was a practical way for me to, like, how can I experience some of that joy more often throughout the day and not just when the doors of the church building are open. Serving and being served, that's part of saying, yeah. I mean, saying yes, you wind up saying yes to serving opportunities, maybe saying yes to going to Post Falls and serving a meal or hanging out with people who are houseless. It could be saying yes to receiving being served, which I think that's a harder one for a lot of us. Like, we want to be the one serving, or we're so independent when someone offers to help us. We're like, no, I got this. I'm good. I don't need that. So one of the joys of saying yes is we've experienced a lot of meals like this with our Muslim friends. They invite us into their home. It doesn't even have to be a big celebration like the end of Eid, like the end of Ramadan or something. This was just come over for dinner and spend time with our family. So the hospitality, like, we have to get used to receiving, you know, from others when we say yes. And probably the one that's been the most impactful, and I'll try to get through this. We were actually in India in 2019, my wife and I were, when I got a call from an assisted living place that my mom was living in and said that she'd had a stroke. And so we're like, okay, we'll do all we can to get back. And she died while we were en route. I'm super grateful that I felt prompted by the Spirit to visit her right before going to India, instead of waiting until after we got back. And then both my kids were able to go be with her before she passed. So it was, her grandkids were like the thing in her life. So having them be with her at the end helped soothe my heart because I couldn't be with her. We got back from India, and an Iraqi family that we know and just love, they called us and they're like, hey, can we come hang out with you tomorrow? Well, I was like, sure. They'd never been to our house. We usually went to their house because they had kids and they lived further away. But we're like, yeah, you can come to our house. They came and they just sat with us. We just sat for like an hour in our living room, a little bit of conversation, but it was mostly just sitting and grieving together. And they explained that in their culture, that's what people do. They just show up. No agenda, no, we must do this. They just show up and sit and maybe bring some food. And it was so humbling to me. And such an expression of God's love expressed from people who worship differently or have a different faith background. And so, yeah, that was a huge, huge, I think, part of our journey is just saying yes. You think, oh, I'm saying yes to doing things. But you actually say yes to entering into relationship with people and receiving as well from them. Sometimes saying yes means getting outside your comfort zone. And this is a picture where I think for others around us, it was outside their comfort zone, and it was new for me. But it was a beautiful, beautiful picture. We were working with an organization based in Ohio that's a faith-based soccer camp. I mean, they put on, it's a soccer organization, and they teach, like, the Bible through soccer camps in the summer. So it's a little bit like vacation Bible school with a soccer emphasis. You know, people go for, like, 6 hours, 5 days a week, a lot of soccer skill from, like, good soccer players, and some Bible study time. And so, I mean, it was amazing. I was a little jaded ahead of time because usually when I saw it in action, it was always in like, oh, the white suburbs where people have access to camps anyway. It's just like, this is just another camp on top of it. But the organizer was like, I'd actually like to do this with people who don't have access. I'd like to do it with people on the fringes. And so, and because they were mostly from other countries, like, who do you know? So I asked a good friend of mine, who's a Somali background, lives in Seattle. I'm like, hey, like, do you know people, kids in the community who would like to learn to play soccer? And he was like, oh, yeah. So we actually put on a soccer camp for a week. It was the first time that most of these kids had done something organized, like, because they'd immigrated here from you know, refugee camps and other places. And we had volunteers from church who come. And there was, you know, the typical Bible school type stuff. And that year it was out of the Book of Psalms, which Muslims actually consider one of the books that they can read. And so it was great. And but when it was prayer time, we were like, yeah, sure, go ahead and pray. Like, I think some churches might have been, oh, well, this is like the Christian VBS, so we can't, you know, do that. But we're like, yeah, like, you just spent some time reading the Psalms, and it's your prayer time, go ahead and pray, and then we'll get back to soccer. So we made space for prayer for these Muslim kids. And you're all thinking, like, no big deal. But, you know, if you've come out of some church context, that's kind of a big deal. So it might make you feel a little uncomfortable. But for us, it was just, to me, it was such an image of, like, what church can be like, what the community can be like. So it was a pretty amazing week. We still know some of the kids, and one of them, they still have their little trophy that they got for something. We didn't hand out trophies to everyone. But I think it was like, you know, who memorized the most scripture that week or who showed the most improvement or whatever. But they still talk about it. And so this is one way to serve, is to look for places. Maybe you're uncomfortable or haven't experienced having a conversation with someone who's houseless. So showing up post-falls might be saying yes to something that's going to make you feel uncomfortable. And that's okay. It's just part of the journey of serving others and recognizing the value and God's likeness in his creation. So I would encourage you to look for what that is. Maybe it's not the houseless. And actually, we've said a lot, yes to a lot of things in our life, my wife and I, that then turned into no's later. And that's okay. I think it's by saying yes to a lot of things, sometimes you learn, oh, I'm really not good at that. Or that's actually not what God has for me. And that's okay. He probably has something else for you. So we kind of feel like just saying yes. I have a good friend of mine who, he says, like, green lights and red lights. To him, everything's a green light or a yes, unless there's a real clear reason why it's a red light or a no. And so it's one of the things that just encourages your thinking about how to serve and maybe stepping into some uncomfortable places. And that might be the last slide. So I think that's it for this part. Yeah. Thanks. No.
We wanted to have some time this morning for some questions or thoughts that you have for Mark. You know, so while you're thinking about that, Mark, I've got... Oh, maybe we'll just listen to some music. I know that you and Lisa have also hosted refugees in your home.
Yes.
Are you? I don't want to get too personal or anything like that, but are you able to sort of share a little bit about what that's been like?
Yeah.
For you too?
Yeah. So in Seattle, my wife has done a lot of work with World Relief, which is a refugee resettlement organization. And that's her primary access to Muslim women, because often when they're newly arriving, they aren't, you know, typically, Muslim women don't hang out in a lot of public spaces. They're home with the kids and taking care of the house. It's easier for me going to coffee shops or whatever to engage in conversation and relationship with Muslim men. So we realized at some point that there was a need for housing temporarily refugees. And then in 2022, 2023, whenever the Taliban retook Afghanistan, you know, there was, if we're watching the news, there was this massive immediate flood of people out of the country. And Seattle has maybe 7,000 people from Afghanistan living in the Seattle area. And there was a big need for housing. And so we actually said yes. We were a little bit further away than they normally would say, but they had such a need, they're like, okay. And one of the advantages or one of the reasons of housing people for 2 or 3 weeks is it stretches the federal government's refugee resettlement money. And so the less money they spend up front before they get into an apartment, the more money is left over for apartment rent. And so we said yes. It was amazing. The first family was, you know, mom and dad and 4 kids. They stayed with us for a couple of weeks. And we still see them. We've been to their oldest daughter's wedding. Actually, the picture of food was at their house just recently. And it's been amazing. And then we've hosted one other family that was it was harder, but I probably learned more. It was like a widow and her little kids, her deceased husband's brother and his 2 of his kids. And they were just much more conservative. And so it was an interesting dynamic in our house with just navigating like her presence in the kitchen and like me, like trying to create space. But we've learned from both families and it's been great. Yeah.
As you can tell, you know, Mark and I both come from a Christian background. Many of our coffee conversations are, you know, our love-hate relationship with this thing called church, know, and things that churches do to bring more harm than help in the world. And Mark, you've had a very deep and rich interaction, particularly with Muslims. Mm-hmm. I know you've done a lot of, you know, Muslim studies and everything, you know, and again, you've been so bold as to welcome other faiths and other, you know, I think Somalian refugees as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how has your faith been formed or changed or inspired by what you've learned from those of other faith traditions?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think there's multiple levels to the answer. I'm going to answer a little bit maybe off topic first, but my wife and I got invited to go to a conference and speak. It was in Pakistan. And it's a gathering of believers, followers of Jesus in Pakistan. And so we had a chance to go do that. But in one of the settings, a couple of the pastors seemed agitated and upset with us. But it was, we represented our government to them. So they had a hard time separating the actions of the U.S. government from people. So to them, anytime we as a government would do something that was, you know, appeared to be anti-Muslim because, you know, attacking a Muslim-dominated country, they then felt like they then received retribution often in their own country. And so it was like, well, no, just like not everyone who is a follower of Jesus is also agreeing with the government. So that was a little bit of a learning to just know how deeply felt that is. And so I think that's even helped in other situations for just how we view, say, like Russia-Ukraine. There's a government thing, it's not a person, you know. So anyway, but I think having other people in our home, just the, sometimes it's just the discipline that they show in adhering to the traditions of their faith, make me wonder, like, what are my faith traditions that I want to hold on to? How much do I adhere to them? And then it's also made me realize, I mean, we know in the Bible that the church is not just a building, but it's the people. I think you use the word ecclesia. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so being with people of other faith reminds me that that's so true. It's not what happens necessarily in here, in this space, but it's what happens with you and others outside. And so we've been prayed for. We've prayed for people of other faiths, just trusting that God hears our prayers. and he's going to do what he does. And so I think it's made us, it's just reinforced and demonstrated that it's not the four walls.
Yeah.
That it's the relationships with people, wherever you're at. Could be your coworkers in the next cubicle. Could be that people two houses down. You know, like in the Good Samaritan, it wasn't the pious Jewish people that helped the man. It was the Samaritan. So he crossed ethnic and cultural boundaries to help. And so, like, I'll say we're blessed in the Seattle area to have so many people from different nations showing up that we are able to live that out if we so choose to saying yes to things that make us uncomfortable. Mm-hmm.
So. And the woman at the well, too.
Yes, exactly. So I think there's so many times where growing up in sort of the church traditions that we have, there can be a bit of a hierarchy, whether it's spoken or not. And Jesus breaks through that clearly in the woman at the well, where he's speaking to a person he shouldn't have been speaking to. Yeah. Do you have a question?
Yes. What's
ecclesia? The question is, what is ecclesia? Great question. Yes. Yeah. So ecclesia is one of many words used. It's a Greek word that means church. When you read, at least in the Bible, you hear the word church, you can be treated this word ecclesia. And it means literally the called out ones. The called out people. Now again, the challenge is we have thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years of history. If you come from a Christian background, you've got all of that that you read back into that word. Okay? But in its original meaning, it was a community of people who were called out. Called out to what? Love. To live love and uplift lives. Again, there's no Catholic church, there's no Protestant church, there's no Methodist, there's no Pope, there's none of that bullshit nonsense, okay? It was just people. So the church is just a community. This is a church. This land out here is church. Card Lane on Saturday is church. A concert in the park on a Wednesday night is church. A painting gathering in our parking lot is church, you know, okay? Now, do we need organizations? Absolutely. But here's what happens if we're not conscious. Organizations work best when they serve the organism. You know, something is happening here. A community of love is forming. So we're going to organize. We're going to structure. We're going to get pastors and buildings, all this kind of stuff, to support that work. But what happens over time is there's a shift. And now we start thinking the organism has to serve the organization. So in order to belong to this community, again, you've got to sign up for some doctrinal beliefs and creeds and all this kind of stuff. And nowhere has that got more sideways than in Christianity, where the whole message of Jesus has been distorted into the kind of this touchdown Jesus, you know, it's all about me. Jesus never made it about him. He made it all about the way that he lived. And this is what inspires me about Mark, is because he takes this and it's not all about that. It's all about welcoming the stranger, you know, offering and receiving what's going on. And I think sometimes, you know, we can miss that. That was a very long-winded answer to your question. So, but it applies to us, right? You know, when we think, you know, in what way does this organization? Someone came up and asked me the other day, "I'm afraid Unity is going to die." Yeah, and I said, "What do you mean by that?" "Oh, we're going to run out of money. We might lose our building." Okay, thank you for telling me that. And then I thought, can Unity ever die if we're an organism? Okay? The building might go away. The bank account may run dry. Now, I don't mean to be flip about that, but I mean, all that can go away. Can that take away from this?
No.
Hell no. Hell no. Nothing can take away from this. So when we think about the future and who we are as a church, it's not from this place of, oh my gosh, we got to keep this place going. This is where, again, then we get into this subconscious mindset that this community exists to keep us alive. You know, no. How can we look at what's going on in the community out there and then be soft enough, malleable enough, agile enough, brave and bold and audacious enough to adjust what we do to support the love that's growing in this community? And this is what I absolutely love about being in Coeur d'Alene in 2026, this time as now, because there is so many cool things happening. And the heart and the soul of this community here has always been to bend, to adjust, to break the rules, to do the things that the other guys maybe just, you know, can't do because they're bound to doctrinal creeds and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we have a freedom here to really imagine and be that source of love and light and support. But it's not rainbows and butterflies and clowns and unicycles, because it's how are we doing with those people that aren't from here? And again, what I love about what Mark and Lisa do in the area of working with immigrants, you know, bear with me here. Conservatives tend to be about build the wall, make sure everything is legal, and keep the bad people out. Let's circle our wagons, draw up our arms, and keep the bad people out. Okay? Liberals say, oh, let's open the borders, you know, let's welcome everybody, but not in my neighborhood. Put that homeless camp over in Post Falls. Put that homeless camp over in Spokane. Put that homeless camp up in Dalton Gardens, whatever. Not in my neighborhood, you know. Oh, yeah, and build the, you know, bring in the refugees, host them. Yeah, let's build a homeless center, you know, to put them in. Mark and Lisa open up their home. And one family, one life at a time, you go through the, you show some of the awkwardness of language and customs and smells and beliefs and practices and traditions, but I really appreciate what you just said, when you can see the reverence that other cultures have, you know, for their faith, and how that's taught you to go, oh, wow, you know, who am I, and where do I believe? I mean, that really speaks to me, so I got way off topic here. You got me preaching. Okay, first. Peter, yes.
Yes, in unity doctrine, if we, our unity community is starting to look at the scientific aspect of God, what is God, who is God, not as a he or Superman in heaven somewhere at 408 below zero, but as spirit. And in fact, I'm doing study on quantum physics and particles as something that makes a spirit, you know, in terms of its energy and what it's composed of. Mm-hmm. I am curious if the other cultures, like Muslims, if there's any talk about this in their faith, that God may not be Charlton Heston crossing the Red Sea, or the Red Sea. I'm curious if the other, especially in the other cultures, like of Islamic culture, where we here in the West always hear about how conservative they are, how anti this and that, and the women don't have rights and all this stuff. Did you have any sense that they would look for, or is that would be too taboo of a topic to even talk about?
Yeah, that's a great question. Just like maybe, it's almost like, how homogeneous are they, in a way? Our experience has been across kind of the map, where you have the super conservative, the family that, with the second family in her home, the woman covered in her home. I could see her on the street today, and I would have no idea who she was, seriously. But that was how they practice their faith. And then you hear other people I talk to that I have, you know, friendships with, they'll talk about the science behind things. And so you do get a really wide perspective in different faiths, just like you would in this room. And you said something that prompts something I didn't share earlier, but like, I think the media portrays, especially Muslims, as a certain way. It's not the fullness of what you experience when you have relationships. And our kids are grown in their 30s, but they went with us to India several times as they were growing up. And one of the things that my son put on a college application was those experiences, and he referenced one of like riding in the back of a motorcycle with a similar age friend, like at 5 a.m. having tea and getting out in the city before it got too hot. He's like, so he had that frame of reference, and then he hears friends at school parroting what was in the media, and he said it helped him be able to share his experiences and then also break like, if you only listen to one thing, then you're probably only going to have that perspective. So for him, it enriched his life. And then my daughter actually did a senior project in India for a couple of weeks working for a nonprofit. And it was among what you would consider undocumented kids. They were undocumented from another state within their country. But there's so many ways, I think, for us to experience the breadth of a faith. So whether they're into science or whether they're not. I think there's a wide range within Islam on that as well. Just like I said, there is in this room, I bet. So, yeah.
Good. Any other questions? Yeah, I'll bring the microphone to you so that our online folks can hear.
I was curious. I have many generations in Idaho, and I meet people all the time in coffee shops. And one thing that comes up often is the perception that Northern Idaho is a certain way with certain people. Mm-hmm. And there is a history of that. But there's a lingering sense of that's just the way it is, and they have fear. It's like, I'm like, okay, I've lived here a long time. It's not my personal experience. But anyway, yeah. My question is, like, you know, the perception of some time that has been lingers, and, you know, it's just interesting to, like, it's kind of back to the relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some media out there about what Northern Idaho is or isn't, and then people, you know, breaking through that. I don't know what the question is, but
no,
just.
I think you answered it. I mean, I think certainly living in Seattle for 30 years, there's a perception about Seattle of politics or, you know, any numerous things. But it's really just, I think, through spending time with others. And saying yes might be saying yes to people who don't look or act like you. It's so easy to look at your circle and be like, oh my gosh, we're all the same. What does it look like to actually step across a line and meet someone in a different life experience? Yeah. Cool. So, yeah. Tammy.
This isn't a spiritual question.
Yeah.
I was wondering, when you're talking about, when they place refugees, mm-hmm. do they try to concentrate people from one country in a city, so they can have a touchstone with people from their own country and feel more comfortable, or is it spread out to where they don't have that touchstone? Yeah. And how do they do those ratios?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like, and specifically, how do refugee resettlement organizations decide in which communities are they going to place people? I don't know how they make the decision the very first time, but once there becomes some people, so like say Afghanistan or Iran or Somalia, people who are coming in probably know that they have a sister or a brother or a village member in that village, and they ask for. So they don't get the request granted, but there is some intentionality of like, oh, this city's already equipped to work with X, you know, name the people group or the culture. And then they do start placing people there, and some of us are like, hey, we've got family, we have a support network here. So it just makes sense. So like the first family that we hosted, they had an amazing support network. Two or three siblings were already here. And so that helped them get jobs and an apartment really quickly. And my wife and I were just talking, and we're like, yeah, that family's thriving. Not just getting by, but they are thriving. The second family, no network. And it's just been a struggle. So I do think refugee resettlement organizations try to place people where there's already some folks from that community. Yeah.
I'm curious, on a more personal perspective, mm-hmm. when you would say yes to an opportunity, yeah. how would you choose which opportunities to involve your children in? And as you were going through those opportunities, how would you make choices to still keep them safe as you're like traveling the world and trying to expose them to other cultures? Mm-hmm. Kind of, how would you guys toe that line between exposure and safety?
That is such a great question, and we are not the poster people for maybe getting it right. I think if we said yes to something, generally we felt like it was a yes for our family. I mean, we didn't always take our kids to India in the early years, but it wasn't because we didn't think it was going to be safe for them. It was just like schedule and school and that sort of thing. But over time, we really tried to make sure that they were experiencing what we were seeing and experiencing. Like, my wife and I are a little bit older, so we were raised in a little bit more, I'll say, feral environment. where there was a little bit more freedom. And so we raised our kids within some safe parameters, but gave them freedom as well. So, we tried to make sure that they were in situations that we felt were safe. But we put them in situations that other people might not have felt they were safe. So an example being, we were in the partner that was in one of the early photos, he wanted to introduce us to some members of the church in a slum. And so these were people that he knew and had relationships with. And so we went, we were with their kids. At one point in time, I realized, like, oh, like, I wonder where the kids are. And so they were just playing with other kids from those families. So later I saw pictures on my daughter's camera of she and some of her friends with the kids having a great time, like, on the rooftop. Other people might have been like, you let them out of your sight? Like, what were you thinking? And that's a fair perspective. But for us, we just had a trust relationship with this man. So then that extended to the people he was introducing us to. Yeah. Yeah. And so our children, it was one of the highlights for our kids, just sort of being adultless for a little bit with people they had just met. Yeah.
Cool. We can do one more if there's one more question. Or are we good? Okay, just one more.
I'm curious, could you sleep at night with strangers in your home? I'm thinking, and could they rest at night? You know, that's pretty bold.
Yeah. That is such a great question, and I can't speak for them.
Yeah.
We were fine in sleeping at night, knowing that other people were in our house.
Wow.
This family that was really conservative, and this could have been a bed restriction thing because we didn't have enough space really for everyone, but World Relief was desperate. The father of, like there was the widow, and it was her brother-in-law. So he actually slept on the floor in our living room. And I often actually wondered, I mean, there really wasn't space for him in any of the bedrooms. But I also wondered if that was a bit of a protection.
Safety.
And oversight, like not trusting us. I don't know. But it definitely made it so that he could see who was coming and going from his kids' room and nieces and nephews' room.
Okay. And secondly, mm-hmm. I'm asking you to hint about a whole huge culture of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a small sample of them.
Right.
But are you, and you may not know, do they come from Pakistan or Somalia, hoping to create their own community, like home, within Seattle? Or do you, or would they make any attempts to integrate?
Also a good question about sort of like assimilation, integration. What I've observed in Seattle and some other communities is that they do want to integrate into the community because they know that this is the environment in which their children and their grandchildren are being raised. So there is a sense of wanting to keep their country's culture and their faith traditions intact, and it's hard to do when you're a minority faith in this country. But most of the cultures, I feel like, are trying to integrate, you know, whatever your benchmarks are, you know, language, jobs, that sort of thing. Where there's denser communities, let's say, like, people from Somalia, it's easier in Seattle to find blocks, like a block here or there, that are more Somali-oriented, grocery stores, you know, barbers, whatever you call it. And so it does feel like sometimes, oh, you're walking into a densely Somali community. That doesn't mean they're not trying to integrate, but it's a place where they can get the food they trust and the community that they appreciate and somewhat mimic life back home. When I think of all, oftentimes refugees have gone through so much turmoil and trauma that when they get here, they're faced with trying to integrate, assimilate to our culture, and yet maintain a sense of family and community. So it's a little bit of a balancing act. But that's where all of us can come in handy if you have immigrants in your community, is you can act as sort of like a cultural interpreter for them. What's it look like to go get a library card or take a bus or call the shuttle to the airport? I mean, there's so many things that we can do that don't seem like they're big things, but they do help newly arriving people feel more welcome and adapt quicker.
And Mark, you were born in?
Where was I born? I was born in a small town in Kansas.
Yeah. Do you know anything of your ancestry, your lineage? Totally putting you on the spot.
Oh, so there's actually a lot of immigration in my family. So my mom's dad came from Mexico with his parents working railroads, just day labor. I have a Mennonite part of my family history, and they fled sort of like Ukraine area when one of the czars was like, you got to serve in the military. And they're like, no, we're not. So they came to Kansas. So, yeah.
Yeah. So just important to remember that this country, you and I, are a country of immigrants.
Yes. Yeah.
My background is Polish and German. My dad's family came and settled in Milwaukee and lived in a Polish part of Milwaukee where they spoke Polish and ate Polish food. My mom's mother immigrated from Austria right before World War II and settled in Germantown, Milwaukee, where guess what? They spoke German. They ate German. Okay.
Yeah.
Is this happening today? Yes. It's a both and.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so, you know, white English-speaking America is the majority, but is it the essence? You decide, okay? That's, I'm not going to tell you that. All right. Mark, thank you. Thank you so much. We appreciate you being here.
All right.